Gustavus Adolphus has the title of the Lion from the North. And we have this coming Sunday, our Memorial Sunday, when we remember those who've died in the wars. And the following Sunday is International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. Tonight we have something of a combination between military, Reformation, and the Persecuted Church too. It all comes together in this incredible character, Gustavus Adolphus, or Gustav Adolf. When I went to the Reformation Museum, I picked up this postcard, and the one thing that I noticed was, aside from the well-known reformers, here is a 17th century man who was a king and a soldier, Gustav Adolf. Now, obviously you understand why you'd have Dr. Martin Luther and John Calvin here, you'd understand why you've got Wycliffe and Huss, Melanchthon, Ulrich Zwingli, William Tyndale. This makes sense. But amongst these eight selected for the Reformation Museum's postcard, there's one man who wasn't a minister of the gospel, who wasn't a professor, who wasn't even in the 16th century. One king, one reformer king, one soldier, Gustav Adolphus, selected, and one wonders why. And I noticed a memorial for him in Luther's Stadtkirche in Wittenberg as well, which again made me want to study more about this very great and amazing soldier, this general, this innovative military leader, and this king of Sweden. Gustavus Adolphus is one of the most inspiring characters of the Reformation. The rapid rise to fame of Gustavus Adolphus, the young king of Sweden, he came to the throne at age 16. His military innovations, his dramatic victories in battle, all of this turned the tide in the 30 Years' War, and it saved Protestant Germany from annihilation in its worst hour. Military strategists like Karl von Clausewitz and the French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte, they considered Gustavus Adolphus as one of the greatest generals of all time. In fact, it was clearly taught by Napoleon that he had modeled much of his military strategy on Gustavus Adolphus. Even more interesting, King Gustavus II of Sweden is famous for employing mobile artillery on the battlefield. He went down to the 6 and 3 pounders. The Spanish at that time had these colossal cannons, which took enormous amount of logistics to cart around the battlefields. And of course, they couldn't be moved very easily. Gustavus said, we will take small cannons, which can be easily wheeled around the battlefields and be more mobile. He also brought about very aggressive tactics, where attack was stressed over defense and mobility emphasized over the usual linear tactics. And he worked on a shock tactic. In some ways, you could say he was the originator of a blitzkrieg concept of hit the enemy hard, fast, where they don't expect it, push through, ram through, and for much less loss of life, you can end a conflict through daring and strategy and flexibility and mobility. His musketeers were widely respected for their shooting accuracy and their reloading speed. They could do it 3 times faster than any contemporary rivals. So, of course, this meant a smaller group of men could have far greater impact on the same battlefield. Gustav Adolphus was an active participant in his battles. He chose to lead charges himself at crucial moments. This wasn't a king who sat back in the palace and shipped the people off. He was at the battlefield. He was often leading from the front. He was repeatedly wounded in battle, including gunshot wounds to the neck, the throat, and the abdomen. Because of an early wound with a musket ball which was lodged in his neck near the spine, due to the extreme pain, he chose to avoid wearing the customary two-part metal armor cuirass, strapped on a metal breastplate and a metal backpiece. He rather went for flexible leather armor instead. Of course, leather is not armor. It helps in sword fights, but it's not going to help when you're dealing with musket balls or cannon shrapnel, of course. Gustavus is attributed with a number of technical innovations, including paper bullet cartridges. For example, in battle, in the chaos of battle, people might pour far too much gunpowder down the barrel. That's why you sometimes had explosions in their face, because in the excitement, you just keep pouring the gunpowder down instead of the measured amounts. So they had these measuring cartons where you would see these soldiers, often the musketeers, having these containers on the front of them. That was, each one was a measured amount that they just had to keep refilling. And then from there, in battle, they just dumped that amount of powder down the barrel and ran the shot down, and then they're ready to prime and go. But he started with the paper bullet cartridges so that they could carry more reloads. They wouldn't have to stop after they've exhausted their 10 or so of these measuring ones, that they would have these paper bullet cartridges pre-prepared. Light mobile artillery, especially the 6 and the 3 pounders, and abolishing the musket rest. This musket rest, if you go down to the castle, you will see that many of the soldiers at that time, their arms are so big, heavy, and unwieldy, that they have to carry the spare musket rest and balance their rifle on it, because unless they were built like Arnold Schwarzenegger, they couldn't hold up these rifles on their own. So, in the interest of mobility and flexibility, Gustavus went for lighter muskets that wouldn't need the musket rest, just one less thing for the soldiers to carry around. He also innovated administrative reforms. For example, Sweden was the first country in Europe to have conscription. They were a small country, only 1 million population. He conscripted from the population so that they could have a large standing army. And they developed the infantry brigade, improved military logistics, standardized artillery calibers. When you realize that the Austrians had 29 different artillery calibers, can you imagine the chaos in battle when you're running short of ammunition for your one artillery piece and the neighboring one's got a totally different type of caliber? It was not logical. So he went down to, right, we're going to have 3 pounders and we're going to have 6 pounders. By that it means the weight of the cannonball was 3 pounds or 6 pounds. These days we determine in terms of the inches or the millimeters across, so you get the 75 millimeter, 88 millimeter, 155 millimeter, and so on. But at that stage, everything was in terms of weight. Gustavus's tactical innovations included perfecting the dashing cavalry charges. Now, at that stage, most cavalry in Europe worked on the basis that they all carried pistols, and they would charge, and when they got close to the enemy, they would discharge their pistols into the enemy, and then they'd ride back, and the next line of cavalry would come up and fire their pistols. Gustavus thought this is a tremendous waste and you're losing your shot tactics. So he would train his men to charge, discharge your pistols into the enemy, holster their pistols, draw their swords and keep charging in, and now use cold steel. You don't, after discharging a pistol, return to the rear and reload. You keep going. And of course this had a great impact because this wasn't expected. Offensive infantry formations. At that stage, you had to have a balance between the pikemen, who had these long pikes, halberds and pikes, and which was primarily to keep the cavalry away from your musketeers, and then they had musketeers. The musketeers fired muskets. The pikemen carried these big pikes, which were phenomenally long. They could be 12 to 18 feet. And those pikes would be used to prevent cavalry to come in on their units by them forming the solid phalanx, such as some porcupine, preventing any attempt to get close. Well, he decided we will not use the pikemen merely for defensive, but for aggressive, for offensive, what he called the push of the pike. You charge forward and you use the pike not to defend, but to attack. And this worked. He also worked on close artillery support, and here you need good mathematicians who are not going to miscalculate, where they can hit the enemy with artillery just ahead of your advancing infantry or cavalry. And so this would clear the way in front for rapid infantry or cavalry advances. Numerous military historians have gone so far as to call him the father of modern armies, and that would not be too much to claim, because he was really an innovator in military matters. And Oliver Cromwell, who came shortly after him, followed many of his innovations. Although Oliver Cromwell had never fought in battle before the English Civil War, he was well read in what has been going on, the battles in Holland and the 30 Years' War. He was well familiar with Gustavus Adolphus's technical adaptions. And so, in a real way, you can say he even trained Oliver Cromwell for his writings. Now, to the Protestants, Gustavus Adolphus is one of the greatest examples of a Christian king. He was known in his lifetime as the Lion from the North, the protector of Protestantism, the deliverer of Germany. His timely intervention in the 30 Years' War stopped the onward march of Austria, the Holy Roman Empire, the Catholic league the Austrian Empire and stop their devastation cold. There is no doubt that Gustavus Adolphus helped change the course of European history. He's comparable to other great Christian military commanders, and all of these studied his techniques too. Oliver Cromwell, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, very similar to them in his devotion to the Lord. But as a reformer king, he can also be compared to King Alfred the Great of England. Gustavus Adolphus was born at Stockholm Castle on the 9th of December 1594. He is the oldest son of King Charles IX of Sweden and of Queen Christiana, who is the daughter of the Duke of Schleswig-Holstein, part of the German coalition of principalities. Gustavus was born during a very turbulent time. His grandfather, Gustavus Vasa, had escaped from a Danish prison in Jutland, had succeeded in delivering his country from the yoke of tyranny, because Sweden was a colony of Denmark before his grandfather, Gustavus Vasa, had won Swedish independence. And because Gustavus Vasa drove the Danes from Sweden, he restored their freedom and was chosen by the grateful country to be his king. And that was the beginning of the lineage. Gustavus Vasa had been discipled by one of Luther's own students. He was determined to make Sweden a Protestant nation, and he instituted reforms in all his states. So you can say that Gustavus Adolphus was a third generation Lutheran. He's come from a line of people who were actually discipled by Luther's own students himself. He required all of his subjects to accept this profession of faith, to serve God by being obedient to his law, by loving him above all else, to believe in Jesus Christ as our only Savior, to study and teach the word of God with zeal, to love our neighbor as oneself, to observe the Ten Commandments. Such is the true worship that we should render unto God. However, despite Gustavus Vasa's sincere faith, the Reformation lacked widespread support in Sweden until after his death, when under son Charles IX, the Swedish Church adopted the Lutheran Augsburg Confession of 1530 as its statement of faith, the official statement of faith of Sweden. Gustavus Adolphus was schooled in the classics, and by age 16 he was not only fluent in his native Swedish and German, but he had also mastered Latin, Italian, Dutch, Spanish, Russian, and Polish. His father was Swedish, his mother was German. This is one of the homes he would have been brought up in. I visited recently during ministry in Sweden. His very austere and strict parents ensured that he is carefully nurtured to champion the cause of the Protestant faith. He is trained as a prince and as a soldier in all the warrior arts. And his family and himself lived very simple, austere, Spartan-type lives. They did not go for luxury. They didn't go for luxurious, flamboyant clothes. They were very straightforward people. Even though they were monarchs, their lifestyle was very plain because they scorned the world's comforts. And Gustavus was not the one to go for cushions and pillows. He was the one to go for fighting in the field with his men and sleeping in the same kind of conditions they slept in and eating the same things he ate. Already from 9 years old, Gustavus was introduced to public life, and he accompanied his father on official business of state. He received petitions, he conversed with foreign ministers, he even joined his father in military campaigns from age 9 already. Gustavus Adolphus was only 16 years old when his father died and he succeeded to the throne. He inherited a country facing critical internal threats and internal disintegration, and the external threats were severe from Poland, from Russia, from Denmark. In the west, there was the war with Denmark. In the east, the war with Russia. In the south, the war with Poland. The country is bankrupt, riots threaten the internal stability of the kingdom, but you can see some of what Gustavus succeeded in accomplishing. Winning back land from the Danes that had been lost. At that stage, remember, Denmark controlled Norway. Winning all of Finland to the Swedish Empire. Winning much of Estonia and Latvia into the Swedish Empire too. Securing the Baltic as a Scandinavian lake, so to speak. His father's last letter to him is still in existence. It counsels Gustavus, fear God, honor your father and your mother, love deeply and sincerely your brothers and sisters, esteem the faithful servants of your father, reward each one according to his merits, be humane towards your subjects, punish the wicked, love the good, trust everyone, but not without caution. Observe the law without respect of person. deprive no one of privileges if they are well-founded and not contrary to the general good. Gustavus terminated the fratricidal struggle against Denmark. The Danes, after all, were their own type of people, and there they were fighting the Danes, and he wanted to bring that to an end quickly. So within 2 years of his coming to throne, he had made the Peace of Kunard, and this stabilized relations with Denmark. He then turned his full attention towards the war in Russia against the sworn enemy of Sweden, Sigismund, the King of Poland, who happened to be related to Ferdinand II of Austria of the Holy Roman Empire. Gustavus insisted on a strict code of conduct, regular worship services in his military camps. Morning and evening, his entire army knelt before Almighty God and reverently implored his aid and favor. Gustavus was seen digging in the trenches, helping to build fortifications, frequently in the front line of battle. He received a tough apprenticeship. In the first 11 years of his rule, he was fighting continuously against the Russians and against the Poles, and he was severely wounded on a number of occasions. But by the 27th of February, 1617, he concluded the war with the Peace of Stolboda, which was very advantageous for Sweden, as Poland and Russia ceded to them a significant amount of territory, which included most of Finland, Estonia, and Latvia, which then was called Livonia. So Finland, Latvia, Estonia were now under Swedish control. Russia was excluded from the Baltic Sea. They had no port on the Baltic Sea. Even St. Petersburg was under control of Sweden. King Gustavus's first concern was to ensure that the authorities of all the conquered cities returned to the Protestants their place of worship and gave them freedom of religion. This is always part of his peace treaties. He fought not merely for territory, he fought to ensure the Protestants received their own. He did not confiscate Catholic property. He did not interfere with their freedom of religion, but he demanded that they handed back what they had taken from the Protestants. Both contemporaries and historians have commented on the extraordinary generosity and magnanimity of Gustav. He treated his conquered enemies with a mildness that astonished both his friends and his foes. There was no vengeance. However, he would not tolerate any profanity, no swearing, no disrespectful jesting concerning the Bible or true religion. He often commented that we should work and live as under the eye of God. God has given me the crown, not that I should fear or remain in repose, but that I may consecrate my life to his glory and to the good of my subjects. He was often found studying the word of God and studying quotations from the scripture, and this saturated all of his conversations and instructions. He was a Bible man. Gustavus was described as a huge man, very big, very strong, with phenomenal endurance. Blonde, broad-shouldered, with a handsome beard and piercing eye, and because of his blonde red hair and pointed beard, he was nicknamed the Lion from the North. He had like this lion mane. Other written descriptions include of lofty stature, tidy, well-proportioned, noble in all his manners and actions. He loved music. He played some instruments very well. In 1620, Gustavus visited Germany to marry Maria Eleonora of Brandenburg, and his marriage was celebrated on the 28th of November 1620 at his palace in Stockholm. However, their happy marriage was grief-stricken when their first two children were born stillborn. And Gustavus wrote in his journal, "Sorrow has come to my house. God has punished me in giving me a dead child." But he accepted this loss as a chastisement from the Lord. He humbled himself under the Almighty. And when Maria and Gustavus were blessed with a healthy daughter, Christiana, Adolphus rejoiced greatly. Now, during this time, what would later be known as the 30 Years' War was threatening to engulf the whole continent of Europe. And Germany was the main battleground between the mostly Protestant North and the mostly Catholic South. You could see how the war rampaged around, causing phenomenal devastation and loss of life. The 30 Years' War was spearheaded by the Jesuits. The Catholic Counter-Reformation was mobilizing a militant counterattack against the Protestant princes of Germany. Their goal was to reverse the Peace of Augsburg of 1555, where King Charles V had been forced to allow religious toleration, where the prince's faith would be the faith of that area. So if you've got a Lutheran prince, it can be a Lutheran area. If you've got a Catholic prince, it can be a Catholic area. and even in the case of the Palatinate, where they had a Calvinist prince, Calvinist people. This had been forced on Emperor Charles V when he abdicated in 1555, but now the Catholic Counter-Reformation was trying to reverse all of this. And the Counter-Reformation Catholics were led by Archduke Ferdinand II, an Habsburg who became Holy Roman Emperor in 1619, and that was a disaster for the Protestant cause. And his rival Duke Maximilian from Bavaria, also Catholic, they led the attacks on the Protestants. The Lutherans were led by the Elector John George of Saxony, and the Calvinists were led by Prince Frederick of the Palatinate, which was a strong Calvinist enclave in Lutheran territory. The Protestants formed a defensive union in opposition to the Catholic League. With Spain seeking to reconquer Holland, the Dutch sought to support their fellow Protestants in Bohemia, who were resisting the imposition of Catholicism by Ferdinand. Of course, Bohemia has been strongly Protestant from the time of Jan Hus, and they want to remain free from Catholicism, but now you can see the Catholics are trying their best to impose Catholicism on Bohemia, and the Dutch see this as a good opportunity to distract the Spanish, who are under, remember, the Habsburgs of Austria, in order to get them to be so busy with the war far away that they will leave Holland alone. So they finance the Bohemians to rise up and revolt against the Austrians. The Bohemians elected Prince Frederick as the king of Bohemia, and he was the Calvinist king of the Palatinate. The Catholic Emperor Ferdinand declared it would be preferable to rule over a desert than over a country of heretics. And to him, Germany was a country of heretics, Protestants. With this, he unleashed a wave of religious persecution and political oppression. And this raised the indignation and opposition of the Protestant majority of Bohemia. And the call to the Protestant brethren in Hungary, Moravia, Silesia, and the Evangelical Union in Germany to aid them in their fight against the common enemies, the Emperor and the Pope. And this is the famous throwing the Emperor's officials out of the window in Prague. And they took them all and tossed them out. And this was what ostensibly began the 30 Years' War. Bohemia rising up against Ferdinand II and the Catholic Union. The first two battles of this war were won by the Bohemians. Protestants scored the first victories. The Evangelical Union sent 4,000 men under Count Mansfeld, who seized Pulsum, one of the strongest Catholic cities of Bohemia. And Count Thurm led the Bohemian armies from victory to victory, and they were at the very gates of Vienna. And they might have won. But with the Austrian army defeated, Ferdinand, at the mercy of the Protestants, a Flemish army from Belgium appeared in the city and saved the Catholic emperor from total defeat. At this point, the new king of Bohemia, Frederick V, from the Palatinate, gave offense to the Hussites and Lutherans, and soon he found himself abandoned by all the Protestant princes. You don't want to alienate your own friends inside, and unfortunately that happened. Here you can see in this map how far the war raged throughout the 30 Years' War. The green areas and the brown areas are where you had massive amounts of war. The wars are where there's green, the brown is where there were massacres and sieges. So you can see it was very, very widespread, up from Latvia, all the way down through Poland, through Germany, into France, all the way down to Spain and Portugal, and it even affected Britain if you count the English Civil War as part of the 30 Years' War, which some would and some wouldn't. At the greatest hour of need, Bohemia found itself alone against the united forces of Austria and the Catholic League. Terrible reversal of fortunes. Overwhelmed, discouraged, the Bohemians were defeated. Prague was taken 9th of November 1621. The initial victory, they were at the very, very, very tip of victory, almost took the emperor himself in Vienna, and then they lost it all because of the Flemish arriving at the wrong time. Ferdinand had 27 of the most prominent Protestant leaders of Bohemia beheaded. Much of their property was confiscated. Many were exiled or executed. All Protestant churches were closed in Bohemia. Bohemia groaned under the oppression of Emperor Ferdinand II. He tore up and burned the pieces of their Bill of Rights, which had guaranteed the religious freedom up till then. Then General Tilly swept over Germany, pillaging, devastating Protestant towns, churches, and villages. And the Protestants knew that these were only a prelude to their extermination. Spain and Austria's early military successes and their plans to occupy a naval base in the North Sea and on the Baltic coast, led the Dutch to encourage King Christian of Denmark to open a second front against the Habsburgs. So Holland's financing alternative Protestant groups to fight against the enemies to give Holland the chance to rebuild. So they're keeping the war away from themselves. So the armies are moving up. The Habsburgs are the red arrows and the Danish are the green. And unfortunately, this is a rash, ill-thought-out move by King Christian. Well-intentioned, but his army was not ready. They got horribly defeated. And the ill-fated campaign ended with the imperial generals Tilly and Wallenstein, two hideously brutal men, chasing the Danes back into own land, and these staggering successes of the Holy Roman Empire. And the Edict of Restitution of 1629 forced all Protestant churches and schools to hand over to Catholic control in these areas. And this provoked a desperate backlash because the people could not allow this. They couldn't allow their children to be brought up as Catholics and to lose all that they'd gained since the time of the Reformation. So the German Protestants at this time appealed to King Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden for protection. After he had won wars against Denmark, Russia, Poland, Sweden was considered a rising power. Although they had scarcely a million inhabitants, they were a real great power in Europe militarily at this point. King Gustav's military achievements were already legendary. He was perceived as the last hope of the devastated Protestant cause. Denmark has failed. The only hope now is Sweden. Wallenstein's imperial army, 50,000 strong, had defeated and dispersed the troops of Mansfeld, occupied Silesia, Lower Saxony, and Holstein. Denmark had sued for peace at Lübeck on the 22nd of May, 1629. Enormous ruinous taxes had been imposed on the occupied Protestant areas. Soldiers were ordered, in the name of the emperor, be active. If any resist you, kill them. Throw them into a fire hot enough to melt the stars. Even the emperor's brother objected in a letter. Your majesty can have no idea of the conduct of the troops. For mere amusement, windows are broken, walls thrown down, noses and ears cut off. Persons are tortured, violated, assassinated. These are certainly irregularities which superiors should and can prevent. And he spoke of those who fill their purses with the blood and sweat of poor people. Discontent is everywhere, increasing at alarming rate. My conscience permits me no longer to conceal from you the true state of affairs. So even Catholic generals were complaining, this is going too far. Cardinal Richelieu, the French Chancellor, an enemy of Protestant Huguenots, was also concerned at the resurgent power of Spain and Austria. He might have been Catholic, but he did not want the Austrians to rise to such power that they could threaten France. So he actually starts to encourage King Gustav also to come in, because he doesn't like the idea of Austria winning either, even though he can't fight the fellow Catholics in this particular war. He saw that France stood back and did nothing and let them know, we will not interfere if you come down, because he'd rather have Sweden win a few battles against the Austrians and see the Austrians continue to advance unhindered in dominating Europe. All the princes of Germany, injured and ravaged, looked towards the King of Sweden in their misery, as navigators look towards a port of safety. Many persecuted Protestants fled to Sweden for safety, and Gustavus called the Senate together at Uppsala and described the increasing injuries suffered by their brethren in Germany and the imminent danger which threatened Sweden if she awaited Catholic control of the Baltic ports. If the Austrians can go north, if they can control the southern ports of the Baltic, it will threaten us. If they've taken territory from the Danes, they will do the same to Sweden. Gustavus determined to rescue the German Protestants from this war of annihilation being waged by the Austrian Emperor. He was aware that he is about to enter a struggle against a sovereign feared by all of Europe, who was thought to be invincible, Ferdinand II of Austria. So Gustavus put his affairs in order. He streamlined his government. He abolished an absolute monarchy. He established a council as a permanent cabinet to make decisions in his absence. And so he moved himself out of running the country, because he saw himself going on this crusade and he didn't think he'd come back alive. With his four-year-old Christiana in his arms, he addressed the leaders in the Hall of Assembly. I am not thoughtlessly engaged in this perilous war, which calls me far from you. Heaven is my witness. that it is neither for my satisfaction nor personal interests that I go into this conflict. Ready to sink under the weight of oppression which hangs over them, the German Protestants have stretched suppliant hands to us. If it please God, we will give them aid and protection. I am not ignorant of the dangers that await me. I have already been in many others, and by the grace of God, I have ever come happily out of them. But I feel that I may lose my life there. And this is why, before leaving you, I commend you all to the protection of the Omnipotent One. He exhorted pastors to ever preach the pure gospel to their flocks and to be examples of true Christian conduct. He wished his citizens prosperity in business and abundant harvest. Finally, I send up to God most ardent prayers for all my subjects. Farewell from the depths of my heart and perhaps forever. Gustavus assembled 15,000 soldiers with 30 vessels of war and 200 transport ships, and he set sail for Europe. As they landed at Pinamonde, he knelt and prayed, O thou that rulest over the heavens and the earth, over winds and over the seas, how can I worthily thank thee for the marvelous protection which thou hast shown during this perilous voyage? My heart is full of gratitude for thy favours. O deign to favour my undertakings here, so that it may turn out not to my but to thy glory. Grant through me to deliver thy oppressed church, and to be to all thy servants, all our faithful servants, a source of great consolation. He noted that the demarcation on the coast of northern Germany took place 24th of June 1630, exactly one century after the Protestants had made their celebrated confession of faith at Augsburg. He exhorted the soldiers, pray without ceasing. The more prayers, the more victories. Think not that I undertake this war for myself or my kingdom. We go to succor our oppressed brethren. By brilliant victories, you can accomplish this generous project. Fear not the enemy that we are going to meet in battle. They are the same that you have already conquered in Russia. Your bravery has just compelled Poland to conclude a truce of 6 years. If you still show the same courage and perseverance, you will secure to the Evangelical Church and to our brethren in Germany the peace and the security for which they are now suffering. The king followed up the speech with a proclamation of military rules and regulations. The soldiers warned that any murder or looting or attempt against life or property would be punishable by death. Their conduct was to be blameless, as they were to be Christian soldiers fighting in a sacred cause. First, Gustavus secured his communication lines with Sweden by chasing imperial troops off the islands in the Baltic Sea, capturing Stettin, and then disembarking at Peenemünde, 16th of July, 1630. As multiple plots to assassinate Gustavus were uncovered, his officers urged him to take precautions. But he retorted, I trust in God. I fear nothing. What shall man do to me? While conquering Pomerania, Gustavus was scouting with 70 of his cavalry when he was suddenly surprised and surrounded by 500 of the enemy. The king's horse was shot out from under him. Many of his men fell all around him during the furious fighting. The Swedes were about to be completely overwhelmed when 200 Finns, who of course were fighting for the Swedes, alerted to the danger by the firing, arrived and dispersed the enemy and saved the king. Several times during his military career, Gustavus was saved from what seemed like certain death by some miracle. On one occasion, men all around him fell under sharp cannonballs and musket shots, so his clothes were splattered with their blood. He himself was shot in the neck, on the shoulder, and in the stomach. He suffered a saber wound in the hand and numerous other injuries. As Gustavus secured northern Germany, the Catholic League mustered two massive armies under General Pappenheim and General Tilly to destroy the Swedes. And here they move out. You can see the Swedes moving down through Pomerania, Saxony, down into the heart of Germany. Gustavus led his men from victory to victory, deeper into central Germany, securing Brandenburg and seizing Frankfurt on Oder after a short siege. But meanwhile, Tilly was besieging Magdeburg, one of the most important centers, one of the richest cities in Europe. But while Gustavus sought to hasten to the aid of besieged Magdeburg, the suspicious electors of Brandenburg and Saxony refused him passage through their states. He is frustrated by the timidity of these electors. Gustavus hesitated to employ force against fellow Protestants. Tragically, after heroic resistance, Magdeburg fell to Tilly's imperial troops. Betrayed by traitors who opened the gates, undermined by the procrastination of their neighbours who would not allow their relief to come over their territory, the richest city in Germany at that time was overcome by fury and savagery as drunken soldiers of nine nations purged the Protestants. The victims were so numerous, estimated 25,000, that they were thrown in wagon loads into the River Elbe. In one church, 53 young girls were beheaded. Croatians laughed as they cast little children into the midst of the flames. The tortures and horrors perpetrated in Magdeburg were so shocking that several imperial officers sought Tilly to put an end to them. His reply was, "I've promised 3 days for pillaging and slaying. The soldiers must have some amusement after so many fatigues." Tilly was a poster child for the Inquisition. Within 12 hours, Magdeburg was a roaring furnace which reduced that vast and opulent city to smouldering ruins and ashes. The fate of Magdeburg was reported throughout Europe as a great triumph in the Catholic areas and as a frightful tragedy to all Protestants. Gustavus Adolphus declared his grief and frustration over the obstructionism which had prevented him from rushing to the aid of these beleaguered brethren. So at last the Protestant princes entered into an alliance with the King of Sweden and permitted his troops to go over their territory. But when the Elector of Brandenburg persisted in a neutrality too favourable to Austria to be tolerated, Adolphus moved against Berlin, and of course that would be his, in fact, brother-in-law. At the sight of the Swedish army, George William consented to make a treaty with his brother-in-law, King Gustavus. By this stage, imperial armies had devastated Thuringia. Gustav moved to rescue Hesse from the advancing Austrians. Tilly then turned on Saxony. On the 27th of July, 1631, the Swedes made a devastating night attack on Catholic cavalry in Burgstall. The Elector of Saxony welcomed Gustav to the fortress of Wittenberg, which put him in possession of the Elbe River. Wittenberg was always an important crossing point on the Elbe River. On the 17th of December, at the Battle of Brittenfeld, near Leipzig, the Saxons and the Swedes combined to confront Tilly's Catholic League. This battle was to determine the future of Protestantism and Catholicism in Europe. Gustavus addressed his troops and reminded them that the very existence of the Reformation in Germany depended on the outcome of this battle. "We battle not for the honours of this world, but for the word and the glory of God, for the true faith which alone can save us, the faith which the Catholics have truly oppressed, and which they would gladly blot out of existence." An artillery barrage lasted 2 hours, and this opened the battle. A west wind blew the smoke of the cannons and clouds of dust from the newly mown fields towards the Swedish lines, and Gustav made such a rapid movement of his troops northwards, covered by the smoke, that the enemy had no time to prevent it. This is typical of Gustavus' tactics, seizing a moment, an opportunity. Here you've got cannon fire creating pillar of smoke, a huge cloud, and so he used that to move his troops so fast northwards that Tilly had no idea what was going on. As Tilly's forces attacked the Swedes, they were received by the most violent fire. General Pappenheim attacked the right wing of the Swedes with his cavalry, but without any effect they stood firm. Seven times the imperial cavalry charged and seven times the Swedes repulsed them. Gustavus threw himself and commanded the right wing in person to respond to threat. Tilly threw all his force against the left wing of the Swedes, but Gustavus reinforced with three regiments just in time to block this move. He could be very flexible and move his men rapidly. Then King Gustavus himself decided the victory by putting to flight the enemy's left wing, seizing the heights on which Tilly had placed all of his artillery, capturing all the imperial artillery. Soon the Catholic forces had to endure the fire of their own cannon. Battered by cannon fire and a general advance of the Swedes, the imperial forces broke, they were routed. A general retreat was ordered, the imperial army disbanded, they fled in disorder. A total victory. Gustavus's victory at Leipzig was complete. He fell on his knees in the midst of the dead and the wounded, and surrounded by his men, poured forth aloud his gratitude to God in an ardent prayer for this decisive victory. Then he rose to pass from rank to rank, thanking his brave soldiers for their sacrifices. In his dispatch to his chancellor, Gustavus wrote, although we have to deplore the loss of so many brave men, we should, before all and above all, thank God for his divine protection, for we were never in so great a danger. Here you can see some of the flags of his units. You can see how he had the men in uniforms of red or blue or yellow, green even, and their pennants, their flags, matched their uniforms, and you could see from the colours which unit was where. The results of this victory at Leipzig were immense. The united forces of the Catholic League and the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire had been annihilated, not just beaten, totally and utterly routed. Barely 2,000 remained of their previously invincible army. Tilly had lost all his artillery, and he had lost nearly 18,000 men. He could only retreat towards Bavaria, a Catholic stronghold. With no imperial army left to stop him, Gustavus liberated the Lower Palatinate, took Marienburg and Frankfurt on Main, and Würzburg. On the 10th of December, he entered Mainz. The Saxon army marched into Bohemia and liberated Prague by November 1631. They had been suffering for 10 years under Catholic oppression. The speed and the extent of these Swedish victories greatly alarmed Richelieu, who had supported Sweden as a counter to the rising power of the Habsburgs, but he was shocked at this dramatic reversal of fortunes. Everyone was shocked. Many people had never heard of King Gustavus before this battle, and now he became a household name throughout all of Europe. Gustavus's march to the Rhine was triumphal. After decades of suffering under imperial troops, even the Catholics welcomed Gustavus as the liberator. They'd all had enough of the ravages of the Catholic armies. In Thuringia, the Duke of Saxe-Weimar became one of Gustavus's most able generals. Historians have noted that the irreproachable conduct of the Swedish army inspired admiration and confidence. In fact, his army had trebled by this stage. From the core of 15,000 Swedes that had crossed, they now had grown three times that number, because they had mercenaries, they had volunteers, people joining from as far as Scotland to come and fight with them. Soldiers who engaged in looting received the death penalty. When Gustavus captured Catholic strongholds such as Würzburg, he organized a government composed of an equal number of Catholics and Protestants. While he insisted on Protestants being returned their churches that had been confiscated under the so-called Edict of Restitution, he ensured that Catholics received the same freedom of worship and security in their property. At one Catholic town where the rulers had persecuted the Protestants most cruelly, his officers urged Gustavus to punish them. The king replied, "I have come to break the chains of bondage, not to forge new ones. Let them live as they have lived." Frankfurt on the Main resisted Gustavus and declared their desire to remain a commercial ally of the empire. Gustavus responded indignantly, "I am astonished to learn that Frankfurt prizes more highly its wealth than it does the duties which religion and patriotism impose upon it. It is indeed little to its honour to talk of the sale shops and its fairs when the liberty of Germany and the future of the Reformation are at stake. It is for the well-being of Germany and for the independence of the Protestant faith that I do battle. No obstacle can stop me, for I am conscious of the justice and the nobleness of my cause." Frankfurt soon opened its gates and received Gustavus with great honour, as wisely as they should. When a Jesuit priest was captured attempting to assassinate the king, literally stab him in the back, Gustavus responded, "The king cannot live shut up in a box. The wicked have not so much power as ill will, and confidence in God is the best safeguard. God knows perfectly well how long he wishes to employ my frail arm. If I fail, he will raise up another instrument more worthy and more powerful than I. His work does not depend on the life of any one man." At the beginning of 1632, Gustavus pursued Tilly into Bavaria. This is the heartland of Catholicism. There he defeated the imperial force at the Battle of Lech. In the face of Tilly's strongly entrenched camp at Rhein, he pursued the fleeing enemy to the fortress of Ingolstadt, where Tilly died of his wounds a fortnight later. Gustavus then liberated the long-oppressed Protestant cities of Augsburg and Ulm. In May he occupied Munich, the capital of Bavaria. The magistrates and citizens of Nuremberg received Gustavus and his force with great rejoicing, and the thunder of cannon and the ring of bells mingled with applause and songs from the enthusiastic crowds. He rejoiced to be in the centre of Germany, in one of the most important, powerful cities of the empire, among his fellow Protestants. Printed copies of Gustav's address to the city of Nuremberg remain. I thank you. I can wish nothing better in return than perseverance in the evangelical faith. Let nothing turn you from it, neither threats nor promises nor any of the passions to which the human nature is subject. Let not the riches of earth make you forgetful of the still more precious treasures of heaven. You have wicked and wily enemies whose aim is the annihilation of Protestantism. Their hope is to found a peace upon the ruin of all Protestants, and they seek their end by the destruction of millions of souls. God has entrusted to you the administration of an opulent and powerful city. So govern it, as not to fear to give an account which you one day have to render at the tribunal of God. In these misfortunes, God has aimed to make us feel how much we are sinners. For you, for the defense of the gospel, I left my peaceful home and came into your agitated country. I've sacrificed the resources of my poor subjects, their blood, my life, and love of my family. I will do for you all that the grace of God will give me power to do. On your side, be willing to suffer for a while, if need be, for a sacred cause. Remain faithful to this cause. Then God will bless you. He will cause your city to flourish. His name will everywhere be revered, and after the glory and honor of earth will come that of heaven. Poems and songs composed at that time described the good king of Sweden, a glorious protector, this new Gideon, the second Joshua who directs the battles of the Lord, this other David who has brought Goliath low, this valiant man whose heart is without fraud and who seeks only the glory of God. Now, after seeing Tilly, the butcher of Magdeburg, suitably punished, Gustavus next rode into Augsburg as the citizens sang Psalm 103 and rejoiced greatly over their liberty. Gustavus entered the city where the princes had first been called Protestants for resisting the Emperor Charles V. When the Emperor Charles V said that he commanded their loyalty, they said, "You cannot command our conscience." And so they protested, and hence they were called Protestants. And so the very term Protestants comes from Augsburg. And this is where Melanchthon presented the great Augsburg Confession, just over 100 years before. And so with great emotion and rejoicing, he moved into this most historic city. At the Battle of Ingolstadt, a 24-pound cannonball swept the king's horse from under him. The man next to him, the Duke of Baden, had his head shot off a few moments later. The king was covered in blood and dust, and all around feared that Gustavus had been killed. He rose from amidst the bodies, declaring, "Neither my high birth, nor my royal crown, nor my weapons, nor my many victories can save me from death. I submit to the will of God. If he takes me from this world, he will not abandon the sacred cause which I defend. I know that I can count upon the aid of the All-Powerful, that he is who has sent me into Germany." Despite cruel treatment meted out on his soldiers when captured by the Catholics, Gustavus resolved to respond to their most bitter hatred by inexhaustible mercy. Many sought to persuade the king to avenge upon Munich the sacking of Magdeburg. After all, soldiers from Munich had taken part in the massacres of Magdeburg. But he steadfastly refused the call for revenge, and he forbade, under pain of death, any crime against life and property. Even the Bavarian priests praised the nobility of so generous an adversary. He might be their enemy, but they recognized he was behaving in a way that they could not explain, that they would not have. Gustavus visited the priests, engaged in evangelical discussions with them, debating in fluent Latin. When some of his generals complained that the king would be better to put to flight these Jesuits than to discuss with them in this way, Gustavus replied, "Why would you persecute these men? Do you not see how much they injure the cause which they defend? How much they help the cause which they oppose? Their very extremism is actually helping our cause and hindering theirs. We don't need to lower ourselves to their level." At this point, the Catholic League was dissolved. Austria lay open on all sides. No army stood between Gustavus and Emperor Ferdinand in Vienna. However, at this point, the old enemy, Wallenstein, was raised up, brought back from retirement, and he raised a new army. He defeated the Saxons in Bohemia, and he marched with 60,000 men on Saxony. Gustavus had now only 20,000 men left, having lost many to disease and even starvation during the sieges. But he could not allow Nuremberg to suffer the same terrible fate as Magdeburg, so he moved with all haste to prevent Wallenstein reaching it. "Nuremberg is the apple of my eye. I will defend it with all my power," declared Gustavus. But Wallenstein stopped short of Nuremberg and encamped in an impregnable position, threatening the Swedes from the heights occupied by several hundred cannon. And this, you can see, is just part of the strategy of Wallenstein, who was actually a wily enemy. And he moved to a position where he could threaten it, so he could not be ignored, but he put himself in a defensive position which could not be taken. There were frequent skirmishes and vicious fighting as the Swedes attempted to take the entrenched positions of the Imperials. Thousands of soldiers were lost on both sides. As famine began to affect the camps, discipline broke down. Here you can see some of the Scottish mercenaries who came to fight for Sweden. King Gustavus confronted his men and his allies concerning these complaints, which afflicted his heart. "I would rather lose life than sully by crime the sacred work which God has entrusted me. I pray you, in the name of divine mercy, to look within yourselves. Question your own conscience. Remember that you must render an account to God for your conduct, that you must one day appear before the tribunal of that judge who sees all things." As Wallenstein began to lay waste to Saxony, causing tremendous loss of life and property, Gustavus marched 20,000 men to Erfurt. He ensured that all the people and their possessions en route were respected. His troops prayed morning and evening, and no disorderly conduct was reported after that. On the march, the king saw a bird of prey pursuing a lark. Incredibly, the lark flew straight down, rested on his shoulder, on the king's shoulder. And the king tenderly took the lark in his hands, and he declared, "Poor little bird, may God protect you." He thanked God for giving him even this opportunity of saving one of his creatures from harm. And he saw in this a symbol of the work that he is called to accomplish, protecting Protestant Germany from the Austrian eagle. In Erfurt, Gustavus was welcomed by his queen, who had travelled there to see him. But he could only stay one day, as the threat from Wallenstein was so severe, he could not delay longer. As he took his leave, Gustavus declared to the queen, "Be of good courage. We shall see each other again. If it may not be in this life, it will at least be sooner or later in the abode of eternal blessedness." He kissed her one last time and rode fast to rejoin his troops, who were already marching for the front. At Lützen, on the 16th of November, 1632, Gustavus summoned his chaplain and spent 1 hour with him in prayer before attending the regular religious services, which were held every morning for his soldiers. He remained upon his knees during the whole service. Before his men deployed, he had them sing the battle hymn he himself had composed. "Notwithstanding the tumult and the threatening cries which resound around, you fear nothing, little flock. Your enemies rejoice in your destruction, but their joy shall be of short duration. Let not your courage fail you. Your cause is the cause of God. Accomplish your mission. Place yourselves in the hand of God, and you shall fear no danger. He will find another Gideon to defend the people and the word of God. We hope in the name of Jesus. The violence and snares of the wicked will turn against him. They will thus become an object to be despised. God is with us. We are with him. Victory belongs to us." And it's his slogan, "Gott mit uns," which was in fact engraved on the belt buckles of German soldiers as a result of all that he had sacrificed for them. "Gott mit uns." A thick fog covered the plain on which the battle was to take place. It was the Battle of Lützen. As the Swedes sang psalms, Wallenstein's cannon announced the impending assault. Gustavus gave the command, "God is with us." As he mounted his horse without armor, his officers pleaded with him to wear armor. He replied, "The Eternal One is my armor." He then rode along the lines to encourage his men. He announced, "The day has arrived in which you are to show what you have already learned in war. Hold yourselves ready. Conduct yourselves as worthy soldiers. Fight valiantly for your God, for your country, and for your king. I beseech you, in the name of a Christian conscience and of your honor, to do your duty today as you have done heretofore. March with courage. I myself will show you the way. I am ready to risk my life and to shed my blood with you. Follow me. Have confidence in God and bear away a victory whose fruits you and your posterity will gather forever." The soldiers responded with shouts of joy and enthusiasm, and at 11 a.m., as the fog had dissipated and the sun brilliantly illuminated the field of Lützen, Gustavus raised his eyes towards heaven and cried out, "Jesus, Jesus, be thou my help this day while we battle for the glory of thy sacred name." He then brandished a sword high above his head and commanded, "Forward now, in the name of the Lord." The king placed himself in the right wing of his army and led them across the trenches that had been dug by the Austrians. When his infantry did not advance fast enough, he dismounted and charged with them to inspire them with a better example. Continually in the front line, Gustavus sought to strengthen each weak point and inspired his men to throw back the enemy. At a crucial point in battle, he became separated from his troops while leading a cavalry charge into a dense cloud of gunpowder smoke. Hit by gunfire, fell and was killed while lying severely wounded on the ground. As word spread throughout the Swedish army that the king was dead, they hurled themselves like furious lions upon the left wing of the enemy, and they cut the imperial forces to pieces. Duke Bernard de Weimar took control of the army and seized the right wing, defeating the Austrians by taking their artillery. Wallenstein was preparing to retreat when Pappenheim arrived with 8 regiments of reinforcements. Pappenheim was immediately wounded, though, and forced to withdraw, dying the next day. All hope of bringing the imperial forces back into line dissipated, and they were routed. Wallenstein abandoned Saxony to the Protestants, who finally retook all the strong places and castles which had been occupied by the Austrians. Wallenstein's defeat was so total that he was later assassinated on orders of the emperor in 1634. That's the thanks he got for being the most capable of the Austrian emperor's forces. The victory of Lützen was more cause of grief than joy to the Swedes. Nothing could compensate for the loss of their beloved king. This is the Stadtkirche in Wittenberg. You can see Luther's pulpit here, and in the floor in front of his pulpit is 1632 Gustav Adolf II of Sweden. And this is the place where his body lay in state after the Battle of Lützen, which is not far from Wittenberg, before the Swedish could come and arrange for his transport back to his home. And here being carried back into Sweden off the ships. His wife weeping over the body of her husband, his coffin, his memorial and tomb in Sweden, and one of the statues in Sweden of Gustavus Adolphus. However, true to his vision, he had remained faithful to his mission, and he'd successfully fought for religious freedom in Germany. He had championed the cause of the Protestants, and he had secured religious freedom for centuries to come. Gustavus Adolphus was a dedicated Christian, a reformer king, a great general. He transformed the art of warfare. He changed the course of history. He liberated Protestant Germany from the threat of annihilation. The whole course of modern history would have been dramatically different had not the Lord worked in such a tremendous way through this courageous crusade of the Lion from the North. One of the history books on Gustavus Adolphus, King of Sweden, and there are different coins in his honor with his emblems. And this is one of his warships, which has been well preserved. It was in the Baltic, and this was his flagship, and it's now in a museum in Sweden. One of his castles that I went past, a church called the Gustav Adolf, in America, the Gustavus Adolphus College. There's many places around the world which honor his name. And Europe in 1648, at the Peace of Westphalia, took a lot of territory from the Austrians and gave the Protestants the freedom which they were to enjoy for centuries later. Here you can see by 1660 the Habsburg possessions had been massively diminished. The Austrian Habsburgs and then the Spanish Habsburgs, that's their territory. They've lost out massively, particularly in Germany as a result of the 30 Years' War. Today, this is Sweden's territory. Of course, Finland received its independence, but Sweden has maintained its main core land. We do have a previous lecture on Gustav Adolphus on the Reformation MP3, although, of course, this presentation, which has been much expanded, and amongst the heroes of the faith, he's also included in that MP3 as well.